Blog Talk Radio. Virginia Woolf appears in two of the novels we're talking about on tonight's Literary New England Radio Show. Today is Monday, January 19th, 2015. I'm your host, Cindy Woolf Boynton, and of these two books that include Virginia Woolf as a character, one was picked by Oprah's O Magazine last week as a mesmerizing winter must-read. Another of the four titles we feature tonight has been likened to Annie Proulx's most magnificent, The Shipping News, which won both a National Book Award and a Pulitzer. I'm so glad you're here with me. Stay for the next hour or so for some great author interviews and book giveaways. Or if you can't stay until the end, remember that later on you can download this episode as an iTunes podcast or stream it from the Literary New England Radio Show archives. Tonight, I'm going to be talking with Michael Crummy on Sweetland, Priya Parma on Vanessa and Her Sister, Henry Faulkner on Sprouting Wings, and Louisa Traeger on The Lodger, a novel about British writer Dorothy Richardson, a peer of Virginia Woolf, a lover of the great H.G. Wells, and a central figure in modernist fiction. I love all things British. My DNA includes a healthy dose of genetic memory and a love for the UK. So I was only too happy for the opportunity to talk with Louisa Traeger about her beautifully intimate debut novel.
The Lodger is a biographical novel about a fascinating writer called Dorothy Richardson, who was born in 1873. Dorothy was a lover of H.G. Wells. She pioneered a new style of fiction that became known as stream of consciousness, and in her lifetime, she was considered Virginia Woolf's equal. My novel covers a brief dramatic period in Dorothy's life, during which she falls in love with H.G. Wells. She explores her sexuality and independence, rejecting the conventions and restrictions of the day, and she finds her voice as a writer.
Now, I'm very well read, but I've never heard of Dorothy Richardson. I'm wondering, is it because I'm from the U.S. and she is someone who's primarily well known in the U.K., or is she someone who perhaps is not that well known there either?
She's not very well known in the U.K. either. She's one of these people that just got forgotten by history. I think part of the reason is that she wrote Stream of Consciousness before anyone else did. So she's sort of a pioneer, really. She's a groundbreaker. But her writing style is quite challenging. And possibly that's why, you know, Virginia Woolf really stood the test of time and she didn't.
So how did you come across Dorothy Richardson and what made you decide to write a book about her?
Well, I found her completely by accident. I was researching Virginia Woolf, actually, and I found a review by Virginia about a writer whose name I didn't recognize. Now, may I read you what Virginia Woolf said about her? Because I think it's just so great. I've got the quote in front of me.
Oh, I would love that, Louisa.
So Virginia Woolf said, "Dorothy Richardson has invented a sentence which we might call the psychological sentence of the feminine gender. It's of a more elastic fibre than the old, capable of stretching to the extreme, of suspending the frailest particles, of enveloping the vaguest shapes." And I read this and I was completely riveted. I thought, who is Dorothy Richardson and how did she actually reinvent the English language in order to record the experience of being a woman? And this was the beginning of my fascination with her.
So Dorothy and Virginia were friends?
I wouldn't go so far as to say they were friends. They knew each other. They both lived in Bloomsbury and they reviewed each other's books. But Dorothy came from a much more working class background than Virginia. She led a much grittier and less privileged life. So they didn't move in the same circles socially. And I think maybe they were a little envious of each other, to tell the truth.
Huh. So this affair that she had with H.G. Wells while he was married, this is factual?
Yes, it is factual. And H.G. Wells, in fact, had a string of lovers while he was married. He had an open marriage, although he and his wife were quite devoted to each other. But he depended on these other women to sort of revitalize him, I think, both as a person and as a writer. They sort of gave him a boost of creativity, and his wife put up with it, although I'm sure it caused her a great deal of pain.
I'm sure it did. And I was looking at a photograph of H.G. Wells the other day, and in my mind's eye, I see him as this really old, like, curmudgeon-y guy, but he was pretty handsome in his younger days.
I think he was handsome when he was younger. He actually had a funny voice, a sort of high, husky, squeaky voice. So he wasn't your conventional Adonis, but he was very charismatic and women loved him. I think part of the secret of his charm was that he made women feel that he was really interested in all of them, in what they were thinking as well as in their bodies. And he was very, you know, intelligent and could talk. And I think that combination was just irresistible to a lot of women.
So now, were you able to find out a lot of information about the affair, or is that where a lot of fiction comes in?
Well, there is a sort of framework of biographical facts about the affair. But one of the things that I like about writing biographical fiction is that you have a lot of wiggle room to be creative, you know, to sort of bring your own interpretation, your own imagination into it.
So The Lodger is your debut novel. How do you feel to have it out there in the world?
Well, it's very, very exciting and slightly terrifying. It's like really sending your baby out into the world, you know, knowing that some people will love it, but some people will probably call it ugly. It's a very strange feeling. I think also, as a writer, the act of writing is such a private act, and then suddenly you reveal yourself to the world, and that's quite a change. But it's exciting. I'm enjoying it.
So now, do you do anything besides writing?
Well, I'm mother of three children.
And you're also a violinist.
That's right. I originally trained as a violinist, and I don't play professionally anymore, but obviously music is a great passion for me. And I think there are many parallels between being a musician and being a writer, like learning discipline, you know, to sit on your own and hone your craft.
So how did you go from being a musician to being a writer?
I actually got ill, and I had to take a year out. But I think that it was possibly the best thing that could have happened, because it gave me the opportunity to rethink my life. And I realized that I wanted to work with words, not music.
Do you see a similarity in the two?
Well, I think it's a very interesting question. And there are numerous parallels between music and writing, such as rhythm, color, tone, and the ability to blend many voices or to make a single voice stand out. So just as an extra beat in a piece of music can throw the whole thing off balance, so a surplus word can destabilize a sentence.
Yes, that's so true. And I'm just curious, when you write, do you hear the music of it? Do you hear the rhythm of it in your head as you're crafting a sentence?
Yes, I definitely hear the rhythm and the tone.
Hmm.
And sometimes I listen to a really fabulous piece of music and just to all those feelings, and I think, well, I wish I could write like that. So it kind of works both ways.
I really love that. So what's been the reaction to The Lodger? Have you gotten any any emails or have any interactions with readers that you've really enjoyed or have surprised you in some way?
You know, it's been really wonderful. People's reactions have been very kind. And as I said, writing used to be a totally solitary activity. So suddenly to find this community of people who are interested in writing, you know, and sort of coming back to me with their feedback has been really great. It's been one of the nicest parts of the whole journey.
And now, Louisa, you're already hard at work on a second book.
That's correct, yes. Actually, I'm giving it a new title. At the moment, it's called Rehab, and it's about a girl who was part of the Kinder Transport, which is the rescue mission that brought thousands of refugee Jewish children to England from Nazi-occupied Europe. And these kids were leaving their families to go to the care of strangers in a foreign country whose language they only had the barest grasp of, which I think, you know, for us living in this sort of relatively privileged and secure age is a very difficult thing to get one's head around. These kids didn't know what would happen to them or if they'd see their parents again, but it was a better fate. Leaving was a better fate than staying behind, you know, at Hitler's mercy.
That must be an amazing project to work on, just
yes.
To give a voice to these kids and to bring this aspect of history to life.
It's been fascinating, and I've spoken to a few of the survivors, which has been very humbling and moving.
Wow. So now, tell us, I know you have a lovely website. Please tell us what the address is. And where's the best place that readers can get in touch with you?
My website, I think, is louisatraeger.com. And I'm also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under Louisa Traeger. So, you know, I'd love to hear from you. Whichever of those platforms is the easiest to reach me on, please get in touch.
And Louisa, what are you reading right now?
Actually, I'm rereading Margaret Atwood. I'm rereading her novels from the 70s and 80s. The one I'm reading at the moment is Lady Oracle, and I'm loving it now as much as I did the first time.
And now why reread it?
I suppose she's such a master stylist. I just wanted to go back and, you know, find out again what I thought was so good the first time. She really gets under her character's skins, and she's just a fantastic storyteller. One's just grabbed by the throat after the first couple of pages.
Sure, and what better way to help improve our writing, right, than to read these masterful writers?
I quite agree. I think the more one reads, you know, the more one learns, and there are always things to learn.
Louisa, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Cindy. It's been a pleasure to chat to you.
Win a copy of The Lodger by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. One of these days, you're going to see me tweet that I'm in London having tea with Louisa. I love London. In fact, I'm trying to come up with a business-related reason to spend some time in London later this year. Maybe I'll write a novel set there. A novel that brings a strong, compelling, fascinating, and too little known about woman to life, which certainly Louisa did, and which Priya Parma did in her captivating debut, Vanessa and Her Sister. The novel takes us into early 20th century London, into the controversial and popular circle of intellectuals known as the Bloomsbury Group, giving us an intimate glimpse into the lives of Vanessa Bell and her sister, Virginia Woolf. Almost all of us know Virginia, but the same can't be said for Vanessa, a painter and a woman with a story of her own, which Priya has written so well that O Magazine touted it as a mesmerizing winter must-read, and pretty everywhere you turn, it's getting tremendous buzz. I asked Priya how she was feeling about all the excitement around the novel.
I'm thrilled and so surprised and happy and so happy.
And for those who aren't aware of your novel, tell us, what is Vanessa and Her Sister all about?
It's the story of two sisters, Virginia Woolf, the writer, and Vanessa Bell, the painter, and in the early part of the 20th century, and their intense, devoted, complicated, difficult relationship. And it's about the Bloomsbury Group before they became really well known, before they were really very famous. And yeah, it's about a betrayal that happened in that part of their lives that's sort of fallen away from Virginia Woolf's mythology. And it's written from Vanessa Bell's point of view in diaries and letters. And yeah, it was hugely fun to write. So
where did the story come from? How did you discover Vanessa? And then what made you say, there's a novel here?
Well, I was reading Vanessa Bell's Selected Letters. I love reading letters. I my background is in academics, and I have always been sort of drawn to primary material and drawn to, you know, the things that people leave behind. And I was reading a letter Clive Bell had proposed, and she was saying no. And this letter was written in 1905, and it was so modern and so surprising. She just stepped off the page as this fully formed person. She was saying, he had asked, and she said, you know, I'm sorry, I just can't marry you. You're a little bit too available. Could you go away and do something else and ask me again in a year, because I just don't know what I think about this, which is not the restrained, demure sort of equivalent of a PC response in 1905. And it was just a character sort of stepped out of the page, and that was it. I fell for them. I fell down the Bloomsbury rabbit hole after that, and it's just emerged now. So it was, yeah, they were fascinating, fascinating people.
How long did it take you to write it, Priya?
I did 2 years of just research before I wrote anything. 2 years. I moved back to London. I actually, I did my graduate work in London, and I lived there for a long time, but I moved back to the States. But I moved back, and I moved to Bloomsbury, and I did 2 years of research, and then I started to write, and it took me 3 years to write, and I was researching all through the writing. So yeah, about 7 years altogether of working.
So I'm interested in,
oh, wait,
you.
I did that math wrong. I'm so sorry. My first novel was 7 years. This one was 5 years. Can I go back and
Yes. How long did it take you to write this novel?
So it was 2 years of just research. I moved back to London. I moved to Bloomsbury, and I was just doing pure research before I ever started to write. And then 3 years of researching while I was writing. So 5 years altogether.
That's a lot of time to spend with a person. What did you, you know, what made you to hang on for so long and just connect with this woman who lived in another time?
I she was somebody you just really wanted to hang out with. I think it would be difficult to spend so long with a character that you didn't like if you weren't obsessed by the sort of the historical figure. She was somebody who was interesting every day, and she was surprising every day, and her letters were so brilliant and so unexpected. And she's the member, Vanessa Bell was a member of the group who left the least behind that is sort of in public circulation. Virginia Woolf's diaries are all published, Litton Strachey's letters are published, but Vanessa Bell only a very select number are published, and the rest are the world never seen. So it was, it was just fascinating, and it didn't feel like 5 years. It felt, you know, really quick, and I really miss them. So it was great to meet you.
I've interviewed historical novelists who really feel that when they were in the flow of writing, that person that they were writing about really was, in a way, speaking to them.
I can see that. I can understand how that would happen. For me, it was, I had a very clear distinction between the real Vanessa Bell and the fictional character that I was creating. I stayed obsessively close to the chronology and to the facts and to everything that's known, but the emotional landscape is really a guess. It's a, you have all of the facts and you have all of the root material, and then, you know, a fictional character steps out, and that was the person I was really spending time with. That was great, which of course was completely terrifying when I, you know, her descendants are very much alive, and they're one of them is a wonderful, wonderful writer called Virginia Nicholson, who's her granddaughter, and so when I actually met her, it was, you know, very, very terrifying to meet the family of the person you're writing about. But she was incredibly gracious and incredibly wonderful, and helped me with everything. And she, I was very lucky. But yeah.
So this might be a crazy question, but is Nicholson, is she related to Nigel Nicholson?
No, different. Weird, isn't it? Different. This is with an H. In Nicholson, she wrote a book called Among the Bohemians, and she's written many books, and she's just a genius writer. So it was a thrill on every level to get to speak to her. She's Vanessa Bell's granddaughter.
Okay, I was just thinking for a moment, wouldn't that be crazy?
I know.
right. I'm a huge Vita Sackville West fan, so
yes.
there's. You know, what a connection there. So
different
did
family,
you,
but closely intertwined.
Did you discover that you and Vanessa had many things in common?
I did. Vanessa Bell was at the point where I sort of pick up her story. She's entering her late 20s, and she's made the decision to, you know, really focus on her art and do what she wants to do. And she's not getting married. She's not settling down and following the established footsteps of where most women, you know, before her had gone. Instead, she's carving out a really different life, and she's living with her siblings, and she's, you know, choosing to wait to marry. And I really identified with that choice, because I waited until, you know, later to get married and do all those things, and watched all of my friends around me, you know, go through those steps, and I hadn't done it yet, and there's a mixture of decision and panic, and she went through that same process of, you know, about, I'm out on the limb. Is this right? Okay, I hope this is right. And so I really loved that about her. It was so gutsy and truthful and interesting. So I did. And she was also obsessed with what she was doing. She was obsessed with her painting. She was, it really was a conversation in her mind when no one else was around. She was really thinking about this a lot, and she wrote about it in her letters, and I understood that too, that you know, drive to follow this interest wherever it leads, because I was sort of under the spell of that. So yeah, I really I really did fall in love with her. And she was just startlingly modern. She didn't feel, I'd have to remember, you know, all of the 1905 details when I was writing it. She feels like she could have been, you know, walking around today. But it was, you know, so she was great.
And you have a very interesting background. You went to Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. You also were educated at the University of Oxford, the University of Edinburgh. You worked with the magnificent Eve Ensler, creator of the Vagina Monologues, among other works for a while. Was there anything in particular in your history that kind of led you to this moment or really influenced your writing of Vanessa and Her Sister?
I think everything does. I think everything that you pick up along the way leads you to gets into your writing somehow. So, it was easier for me, the UK phrasing and everything for me was easier for me because I had lived there for so long, and then the research, all of the, you know, the enormous amount of historical research that you have to do. I'm very comfortable in archives and you know, being the youngest person in the room by like 40 years and being working with all this stuff. It was great. And then working with Eve, she's a force in the world. She's incredible, and it was an incredible apprenticeship. She taught me so much, and so much of what I learned from her was about writing in the first person and really hearing and just having a huge appreciation for women and their stories.
Priya, who do you think will enjoy Vanessa and Her Sister?
Anybody, really, I hope. You know, you never know, but it's a story about sisters. It's a story about how this one woman dealt with her very brilliant but difficult, challenging sister at an exciting time in her life when everything was changing, and there's a huge sort of betrayal that happens, which I don't really want to say what happens, but there's a lot that would stop Vanessa Bell from being happy, and this is how she negotiated that and how she learned that. So it's really a story for anybody. It's not the traditional Virginia Woolf that you learned or that I learned about in school. She's different from her mythology. She's a brilliant writer, but a troublesome person, and was just great fun to write. So I hope everybody, I don't know, you can never guess who's going to like it and who's going to not, but I hope, you know, anybody.
Priya, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me.
Weeks from now, The Girl on the Train author Paula Hawkins will be on the show. She'll be one of my guests on February 9th, and will also be giving away copies of the book that night. It's being called the most hotly anticipated thriller of 2015, and better than Gone Girl. I blogged about my experience reading The Girl on the Train. I posted it today on Literary New England's Tumblr page, explaining, among other things, why I like The Girl on the Train's Rachel so much better than Gone Girl's Amy. Lots of things didn't get done at my house after I started reading The Girl on the Train. Keeping me equally preoccupied right now is Michael Crummy's Sweetland. Sweetland is not a thriller, it's a stark poetic drama about a place and a man, about a remote island off the coast of Newfoundland where its eccentric inhabitants have lived for 12 generations, though maybe not for much longer. The local government is offering each islander a generous resettlement package to move to the mainland. Moses Sweetland says no. Michael and I started our conversation talking about the book's title.
It's a person and a place. And the island where Moses Sweetland, the main character for the book, lives, is actually named Sweetland and named after his family. He guesses because they were the first Europeans to settle there. Although that whole history, as is the case with a lot of these communities, is kind of foggy because it goes so far back. But there is the connection between Sweetland and the place where he lives is very tight throughout the book, which is part of the reason I wanted them to have the same name.
I am totally enthralled and can quickly see why it is a book that is getting so much buzz. How do you feel about the reaction to it?
I'm thrilled, of course. I mean, I like all writers, I spend most of my time sitting alone in a tiny room in my head, you know, and you never know when you're working on a book how anyone else is going to react to it. So it's always a bit nerve-wracking sending it out into the world, but when people respond to it the way they have to this book, you know, it's pretty gratifying.
So now Sweetland is not your first novel, but is it fair to say, at least in the U.S., it is the novel that's gotten the biggest buzz?
I think that's fair, yeah. I had a book called Galore, which came out in the States about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and was kind of, it was with a small publisher called Other Press, and was kind of an underground book, but did very well in terms of reviews and that sort of thing, and I think the momentum from that book has been picked up with this one. I'm working with the same editor, and she has been a real champion of both of these books, and this is definitely the book I think that has gotten the most advanced buzz. You know, the book's not even, it's today, it's out on the 19th in the States, that's the official release, so this is the first book that has gotten this much attention before it's even hit the stores.
So now, is there really a place called Sweetland?
No, in fact, there are many people in Newfoundland called Sweetland, but the island itself is a fictional place, and part of the reason I decided to do that is because what the people in the novel are facing is something that a lot of the smallest communities in Newfoundland, the most isolated communities, are facing, you know, which is that with the loss of the cod fishery, there's nothing to sustain them economically. And some of them are taking government packages and are leaving as a group and moving somewhere more central. But I didn't want to write about a real community because those places are so specific. They're tiny communities with a handful of families. And I don't know them well enough to write about them in a way that would be convincing. So I decided I would create a fictional community that's going through some of the same experiences.
So where did the story come from? I mean, is this something that you or someone you know has actually gone through?
It's not something I've gone through, but resettlement is something that has a long history in Newfoundland, and it's a very controversial practice. In the 50s and 60s, it was actually a huge social engineering project by the government to move the smallest, most isolated communities somewhere more central where they could provide services to them. So over the course of a couple of decades, the government targeted and resettled, I think, 300 or 400 communities, about 10,000 people. And a lot of people felt like they were forced to move. And there are still a lot of bad feelings about that. What's happening now is communities are actually going to the government themselves because there is nothing in these places without a cod fishery. All of the young people are leaving to find work elsewhere. The demographic in these communities is skewing older and older. So they're going to the government and saying, give us a package and we'll move. And then the government is interested because they don't have to run ferries out there. They don't have to provide health care to those folks anymore or try to keep a school open. But the proviso has always been, up until very recently, everybody has to sign on to the package. they won't consider giving a package to a community unless everybody agrees to move. I started really hearing about this as a contemporary issue about 6 or 7 years ago, and it at the time I thought a story about the one person in one of these tiny communities who refuses to sign on and what happens within that community then, that might make an interesting book. And that's really the setup for Sweetland.
So when you decided to tackle this subject, were you looking to make a political statement? Because ultimately it's more, even though politics and an issue kind of is the instigator, it's really the story about a man.
Yeah, no, I never thought of it as a political book. I think I tried to create within the community a sense of some of the politics among the neighbors, you know, in terms of the kind of back and forth that would probably go on. But for me, and I wasn't really aware of this until I was finished the book, resettlement is the setup for the book, but really it's a book about mortality. You know, Sweetland, who eventually, and I don't want to give too much away, but eventually he ends up on that island by himself, and no one knows he's there. And the last half of the book is about how he faces that isolation and that loneliness, you know. And it really is a book about mortality and how we face that says about us as people, you know. So, and it's a very strange thing. When I was writing the first half of the book and creating Sweetland as a character, I was dropping in a lot of things from my father's life. There's the setup in the family where Sweetland is his father dies when he's young, and he more or less becomes a father to his youngest sister. That's my dad's story. And there's a saucy rooster who goes after his sister that Sweetland kills in a rage, and that's my dad's story. And there's all kinds of things like that. I'd never sort of pillaged my father's life that way before. And I thought, I didn't know why I was doing it, but after I finished the book, it's clear to me that I was writing through the experience of watching my father die of cancer about 12 years ago, you know. And what Sweetland endures in the second half of the book in particular, there are a lot of parallels in what he goes through to what a person with a terminal illness might face.
One of the first things I wondered when I saw that he is a man who's on this island alone is, did you physically, to write this book, you know, place yourself in a really deserted spot for a couple of days so you would have to physically, you know, go through some of the things that he might have?
Right. No, I didn't. I mean, I have spent some time in the bush in Newfoundland. And I've spent a lot of time on the islands around Newfoundland, so I have a very good sense of the landscape and also of the weather, because the weather is in Newfoundland is pretty extreme at times. And so I had a pretty good sense of what living in that would be like. But in terms of what it would be like to live there alone for an extended period of time, that was all sitting in my little office and trying to imagine the kinds of things that he would be facing while he was out there.
So tomorrow you're going to be in Mystic, Connecticut on one of your stops supporting Sweetland.
That's right.
What is it that you enjoy about hanging out with readers and talking with them?
Like I said, I mean, most of my life as a writer is sitting alone in a room. And it's a really, really great experience to actually be out with people who are reading books and want to talk about this private little world that you've created. And I've also really learned to enjoy the whole experience of reading to an audience. You know, I feel like it's a really fantastic way to engage with a group of people. And also, my favorite part of it all is the Q&A. Just being able to answer people's questions about the book itself or about the place I'm from. You know, not a lot of people outside of Newfoundland are really familiar with the place. And that includes people in other parts of Canada. So I really enjoy just trying to give people a fuller picture of the place that I come from and the world that that book has been created out of.
That's awesome. I'm sure that your event tomorrow is going to be very well attended. Michael, what's your pitch for Sweetland? Who should pick it up?
Anybody who's interested in learning about a place on the margins would find this an interesting book. But also, I think anybody who has experience of loss, you know, I think anybody who's gone through something in their lives where they've lost something really important to them, I think they would find a kindred soul in this novel, you know. And I hope, I mean, it's in many ways it's a pretty dark book, but it, my sense of it and the response I've been getting from readers is that it's not at all depressing. In fact, it's exactly the opposite, you know, that it's people come away from it lifted exactly, then sort of braced by it. So I think that it would appeal, I think it would appeal to anyone, really. That's my hope, anyway. That's what I set out to do when I'm sitting down to write a book.
That's right. Everybody should read this book.
Let's go with that. It will appeal to absolutely everyone.
There you go. Thanks so much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure. I really appreciate the call, Cindy.
Michael, who's from Canada, is in New England this week touring for Sweetland. Right now, as the show airs live, he's in Massachusetts at Brookline Booksmith. Tomorrow, Tuesday, January 20th, he'll be at a lunch at Bank Square Books in Mystic, Connecticut, followed by appearances Wednesday, January 21st, at the Water Street Bookstore in Exeter, New Hampshire, and on Thursday, January 22nd, at Sherman's Books and Stationery in Portland, Maine. Learn everything you want to know about Michael and Sweetland by visiting sweetlandnovel.com. Henry Faulkner of Massachusetts worked in airplane design and was a pilot before becoming a novelist. His first book is the recently released and historical Sprouting Wings, which takes readers to 1940s America, shortly before the U.S. enters World War II, and introduces us to protagonist Alan Erickson, following his journey from rookie pilot to respected military squadron member. Henry and I chatted about where the book came from, as well as how it serves as the launch point for more to follow.
It's intended to be the first of a series about a young man who becomes a naval aviator and fights in World War II in the Pacific as a carrier pilot. And this first book is kind of introducing the reader to him and giving all the background so that as in later books, you know, have an understanding of his background. And it's also intended to be an interesting story in itself, and he has some difficult choices to make and is able to make a transition and grow in a new career or different direction in the Navy. And also it's kind of about the adventures of becoming a pilot, and particularly a military pilot. And obviously it's a really dangerous business and lends quite a bit of excitement.
So what made you decide to write a novel about this time period and to focus on a pilot?
Well, I was born just before we got into the war, and my earliest memories are during the war, so it's very much been part of me my whole life. I guess aviation has been pretty important too, in that I naturally got interested in a young boy growing up, and one of my older brothers was into it, and So I knew quite a bit by the time I was a teenager and began to read about it in high school in more detail. And then after college, I had a chance to learn to fly, and I became a pilot. And so it's been a big part of my life ever since. And so writing about a pilot in World War II was a natural thing. And naturally, you know, as a pilot, you hear a lot about World War II and about the airplanes and the heroic stuff that went on. And it's pretty easy for a young man to imagine being in it, even if you're quite a bit too young to have been in it. And of course, you imagine being in the current military, whatever it is at the time, and being a pilot in that.
Did you have a fantasy about being a World War II pilot? I mean, is that something you kind of imagined?
Oh, yes, from time to time, yeah. And I'm nearsighted. If I had not been nearsighted, I might have wound up in the military flying. I enjoyed it a lot and was not averse to the idea, although I think my parents would have been horrified.
So you are, if I understand things right, you're an aeronautical engineer by trade. How did you go from that into becoming a novelist?
Okay. I had an enjoyable career, but I actually wasn't really an aeronautical engineer after the middle of my career. I was a mechanical engineer. I decided I wanted to stay in my home area in New England, and the opportunities to continue in aeronautical engineering are pretty limited. So I made a transition. I did, as I said, I did some flying, and then I think the thing that started me on the idea of writing about it was reading historical novels, mostly about the Napoleonic period and the Royal Navy. So C.S. Forrester, Alexander Kent, and then later Patrick O'Brien. And it was really O'Brien that gave me the idea, not that I could write anything like him, but that I could write something that might be acceptable and interesting to readers. Because his books are as you probably know, are pretty dense with historical material and detailed descriptions of things. And yet they were very popular, and not just with young men like me or older men. I've run into quite a few women who enjoyed reading them. So I thought, well, maybe I could do something along those lines, but set it in World War II. And I was not aware that there were any, at that time, any historical novels written set in World War II, at least in the Pacific. And, I've become aware of some since, but there aren't really too many that overlap very much with what I'm doing.
Go ahead. You go ahead.
I gradually narrowed my focus to the early part of World War II in the Pacific and the carrier wars and so on. And that part really hasn't been covered very much in historical novels. I'm only aware of one that falls into the first 6 months of the war in the Pacific. And I enjoyed it, but I noticed that nobody's ever heard of it. It was written by a man who's has a long reputation for nonfiction about World War II topics, and so He, you know, naturally, some people will buy it on that basis, as I did. But it's a fairly open field. Let's put it that way.
It is interesting to me how little has been written, both on the fiction and nonfiction side, about the war in the Pacific.
Right. And almost all of it is about the later parts, which were the scale continued to increase, and grander and grander conflicts took place. But to me, fairly early on, not sure exactly when I came to this conclusion, but the early part is quite a bit more interesting because it wasn't inevitable what was going to happen. It became, around the middle of the war in the Pacific, it became inevitable that we were going to defeat Japan. And it wasn't clear exactly how or exactly what the losses would be in the process, but it was going to happen. And in the early part, that wasn't so clear. The military have an expression, the issue is in doubt. And that means that they're usually going to battle with the assumption that they're going to win. And if that assumption becomes questionable, that's the expression they use. And it's also a way of saying, now's the time to commit the reserves. And, if we're holding anything back, we shouldn't be holding it back any longer, and that sort of thing. And and so that was kind of the situation for the first year or year and a half of the war in the Pacific. And there wasn't anything being held back, so there wasn't anything additional to commit, really. The war in Europe had already been assigned higher priority, even before we got into the war, had been decided. So it was playing second fiddle all along, but it became more and more important to at least some people not to let the Japanese interrupt our communications to Australia or invade Australia, to try and limit the damage so that we would, make it a lot easier to get started on the offensive eventually.
So in Sprouting Wings, how much fact about military history do we see? I mean, is everything related to the time period for the most part? Is it fact? I mean, certainly the things that happen to your characters aren't. But as far as the war events and some of the experiences of being a pilot, that's all true?
Yes, so far as I could make it. I follow the history very closely. And some of the things that might seem like sort of storytelling, like the crash landing of the Corsair airplane, the experimental one, that actually happened. And the pilot wrote a book about it. And I have that book, and I've followed what he said in there. Now, the fact that my leading character shows up at the crash site is obviously fiction, but that actually happened on that date in that place. So,
Henry, your protagonist, Alan Erickson, how much is he like you?
Well, certainly there's some overlap, but he's a little different. He's a little bit like sometimes I wish I could be. I'd have to sort of stop and think what exactly is different. He is a little bit shy, but not as shy as me. he's more outgoing. And probably a little more, a little less risk averse.
Henry, is there something that you hope your readers walk away from Sprouting Wings Is there something you want them to have felt or to have discovered?
Well, yes, I'd like them to feel like they have been there, been present at that time to some extent. So it's a way of bringing a history to readers that might not read straight history, nonfiction. And also to just tell an interesting story about a fairly ordinary guy and what he gradually got into. Because that's really a lot of the message of World War II, is that ordinary people did extraordinary things.
Henry, we need to wrap things up, but I just want to talk about this is Sprouting Wings is the first in a trilogy.
Well, I actually have plans for 5 books, although the
fifth is goodness.
More nebulous than the others. But I have a pretty definite outline for 3 more. And I'm working hard on the second book and more than halfway through it, I think.
That's fabulous. And will we see Alan Erickson throughout?
Yes.
That's terrific. Something to look forward to. Henry, thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay. Well, you're very welcome, and thank you.
Win a copy of Sprouting Wings by sending us an email to litnewengland@gmail.com or tweeting us at @litnewengland. I'm so grateful to all of my guests for being on tonight's show. Thank you, Louisa Treger, Michael Crummy, Priya Parma, and Henry Faulkner. Next week on the show, we'll be featuring Heather Webb on Rodin's Lover, Megan Mayhew Bergman on Almost Famous Women, Allison Jean Lester on Lillian on Life, and Nellie Herman on The Season of Migration. In addition to great author talk, we're going to have great book giveaways, so I hope you'll be with us again. Until then, have a great week and great reading. Thanks so much.